Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, September 19th, 2013. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, Dick Cantwell, a founder of Elysian Brewing in Seattle, talks to us about his book, The Brewers Association Guide to Starting Your Own Brewery. If you're new to home brewing and would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. You can follow me on Twitter. My username is basicbrewing, all one word. Also, you can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing.james. And our show page is on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing. We're on Google Plus, too. And thanks again to everybody clicking on the Amazon.com associate link on our basicbrewing.com site. You know how that works. Whenever you have the itch to go Amazon shopping, go to our website first, basicbrewing.com. Click on our ad, then it'll take you to Amazon where you can shop as you normally do. It won't cost you any extra, but we will get a chunk of whatever you buy. We greatly appreciate your support. We also have associate links for Brew Your Own Magazine and the American Homebrewers Association on our site, too. You can find our Basic Brewing iPhone app on iTunes and our Android app on Amazon.com. We're on the BlackBerry podcast directory, and we're on the Stitcher app as well, and we're on the Windows Phone directory, too. Check out our Brewer's Logbook at basicbrewingshop.com, and the front is a blank calendar that you can use to track your fermentations and plan your brews, and there is room in the back to log the details of up to 50 batches of beer. If you want to put a tip in our tip jar, some coinage in our guitar case, you can go to basicbrewing.com/support, and thanks to everybody who has done so already. And finally, you can protect your precious beer with one of our growler bags. Check those out at basicbrewingshop.com. There is a new Basic Brewing video out there. In this week's episode, we try my spur-of-the-moment saison that I wrote about on beerandwinejournal.com. I showed you how I brewed that one on the show. And also on the show, I spring a surprise on Steve. I did a little experiment. I bottled some of the beer in some of those 16-ounce aluminum pint bottle can thingies that one of the big boy beers is packaged in. You know, it looks the bottom part looks like a can, and then it tapers up into a resealable wide mouth, of course, wide mouth, because you want to drink that stuff as quickly as possible, apparently. Anyway, it's a resealable can bottle thingy. And I just said, hey, it's resealable. It's like a bottle. I'll just bottle my homebrew in it and see if it works. Did it work? Check on the video episode to see. Lots of rain and flooding out in Colorado recently. That's the beer mecca, of course. And I've been reading reports from there, and it sounds like some scary stuff. And Chris Colby wrote an article about that on beerandwinejournal.com. And there was a link to an article from there that showed pictures of bags of grain being used for sandbags at Left Hand Brewing. So I hope you and yours and your property and all that are safe out there in Colorado. Water is scary when there's lots of it and it's moving quickly. Let's take a quick look into the mailbag. Neil from Nuchitsa in the Czech Republic wrote this. Neil says, I just finished listening to your last show with Chris Loring and thought I would suggest a name for his style of operation that is more appealing than gypsy brewing. Like him, I also have a great love for Czech beers. In fact, I've lived in the Czech Republic for the past 8 years or so. There's a brewery here that operates in a similar way to him. They don't have their own premises. Rather, they move from place to place, brewing different beers in different Czech breweries. They call themselves Pivovar Nomad. That's nomad brewing. I think it's a much nicer term for this type of operation. It sounds good to me. Of course, whenever I hear the word nomad, I instantly flash back to a floaty, deadly space probe from Star Trek. But that's just me. Incidentally, when the Star Trek exhibit out in when they had the ride out there at the Las Vegas Hilton, I took a picture of Kelly Dodson beside that very prop, Nomad. That's a little bunny trail that I went down there. David writes, just brewed a pale ale. First time I've steeped grains before, and I'm planning on another first with this beer, dry hopping. Ooh. That aside, I know someone who is making a survey of commercial pumpkin brews, and that got me thinking. I'd really like to do some small batch pumpkin brews. Not sure if I'm looking for more of the pumpkin spice than the pumpkin beer itself. Well, David hits on a bit of a controversial topic there. It's a bit of a debate in the homebrew community. Some say it's all about the pumpkin pie spice, while others swear that the pumpkin itself lends its own character to the beer, especially if you roast the pumpkin in the oven for a bit. David goes on in the letter to mention that he's looking for extract recipes. And I think you're probably going to need to mash the pumpkin in an all-grain batch. If you don't mash it, I think what you're going to end up with is a fairly starchy beer. If you disagree, let me know. If you've had good results of doing extract without mashing pumpkin, let me know. I think if you want to stick to extract and not go all-grain, I would go with the spices alone. And if you do an internet search, you'll find a ton of different recipes out there. Some just use the, you know, the pumpkin pie spice pre-mixed spice bottle or jar or whatever and have good results with that. Some others, you know, take more of an old-fashioned approach and mix the different spices to get their good results as well. Lots of different approaches. So take a look out there. Do a recipe search or a internet search for recipes for pumpkin pie or pumpkin spice beers and kind of borrow the spices from one of those and add it to a standard extract recipe. David mentions he'd like to brew a pumpkin porter in his email. And I think that would be tasty. And certainly lots of extract porter recipes out there. Certainly lots of pumpkin beer recipes out there. So anyway, especially if you wanted to do a small batch, experimenting with it would be fun. But always be aware that it is easy to overspice. But in my experience, I made kind of a potpourri beer one time. But even with time, I kept that beer around for about a year. And after about a year, those spices came in line and it turned out to be a good beer. Now, a word from our sponsor this week. You know that Basic Brewing Radio is one great way to stay in touch with all things home brewing. Another great way to learn more about brewing better beer? Joining the American Homebrewers Association. More than 37,000 members rely on the AHA for great benefits like events, web resources, Zymergy magazine, and money-saving AHA member deals. As a not-for-profit organization, the AHA relies on members to support the work to promote, protect, and grow the homebrewing hobby. Whether you're an expert homebrewer or just getting started, visit homebrewersassociation.org to join today. And speaking of pumpkin beers, in the latest edition of Zymergy, the cover is a really cool illustration for a pumpkin beer recipe. So there you go. There's your ticket. Okay, let's move on to the meat of the matter this week. One of the benefits of doing this podcast is getting review copies of books. And I was really excited to get this one, The Brewers Association Guide to Starting Your Own Brewery. I like to say that most home brewers dream about starting their own breweries while they're stirring the brew pot, but there is a lot more that goes into it than just making good beer, of course. You got to build a business first. And Dick Cantwell has been down that road. He's built a business, a successful business, brewing good beer. And he gives us some insight on what it's like to make that trip. Dick Cantwell, welcome to Basic Brewing Radio.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You are one of the founders of Elysian Brewing Company up there in Seattle. And
yep.
Your book is The Brewers Association's Guide to Starting Your Own Brewery. And I guess it might be fun to start with your own story. How did you go from being a home brewer to being a professional brewer?
Well, it was a combination of factors, I think, like all of us. I was writing as full-time as I could manage it and supporting that by waiting tables and bartending, which I've been doing for some time. And that sort of feeling like I was kind of reaching the end of the productivity of that arrangement. Homebrewing had started up with me, and I decided to try to get a job doing that. But I think what got me more serious about homebrewing was the birth of my daughter, really, because since I was waiting tables and bartending in the evenings, leaving my days free to write, I took care of her during the days while my ex-wife, then wife, was off at work herself. And so I did that for about a year and a half, and I started homebrewing, and I found that I just didn't have those long blocks of time anymore, taking care of a kid during the day, and that I needed to write. And so brewing was something that was creative, that sort of answered that need for me, and that I could do while she was around. So I could brew, I could bottle, I could do all this stuff more effectively, even when she was around. So that made me maniacal as a homebrewer, and coincided with my discontent with bartending and waiting tables and all that stuff. And we decided to move to Seattle. I was doing that homebrewing in Boston, where we lived then. And so we arrived in Seattle in 1990, and I took around a mixed six-pack of my homebrew to every brewery in town. Was actually offered two jobs, and took one of them and worked there for about a year. That was a brew pub that was unfortunately ill-fated, only lasted about a year and a half. And then I went to what's now Pike Brewing Company, then was called the Pike Place Brewery, which was in the Pike Place Market. And I worked there for 2.5 years. Then I was recruited to become the head brewer at Big Time Brewery and Ale House in the University District here in Seattle. And while I was there, I was put together the business plan with my two partners, and we started Elysian in 1996.
So you had some on-the-job training. You didn't go straight from the kettle on the patio to your own storefront with your own brewery. You kind of got to know the ropes along the way.
Yeah, that's right. And that's a course that I really do recommend, not just here in this conversation, but in the book. You know, I think it's a great way to learn the ins and outs of the business, a great way to earn your chops as a brewer, to work for somebody else, hone your skills that way. Rather than, I think, an awful lot of people are just jumping directly from being a home brewer to starting their own businesses. And, you know, it's a different model, but I think it's certainly advisable to get some training.
Your book, when I read your book, it reminded me of a video that I once saw from the Arctic Alaska Fisheries Company, which was based in Seattle. I don't know if it's still around or not, but this was a recruitment video, but it wasn't so much a recruitment video as it was a discouragement video, because they showed this to potential new hires, and what they wanted to do was to give you a realistic view of what goes on a fishing vessel, because it's near impossible to get home once you're out in the middle of the ocean and you decide you don't want to be there anymore. So, this video was kind of a dose of reality to these, you know, mostly college kids who were wanting to make a lot of money over the course of a summer fishing in the waters off of Alaska. So I get the same kind of impression from your book, in that if you make it to the end of that Arctic Alaska video and you still wanted to go on the boat, you know, you were well prepared. If you get to the end of this book and you still want to be a professional brewer, at least you have kind of an idea of what you're getting yourself into.
Yeah, I certainly don't mean to be discouraging, and I hope it doesn't come off that way, but I have gotten, you know, both kinds of responses from people about the book. You know, some people who say, oh, that's, you know, this was very helpful in getting started with my project, but I've gotten a couple of what to me are really gratifying responses, too, from people who either decided not to do it or who realized they weren't quite ready. I got an email from a guy a couple of weeks ago who said he was in the early stages of trying to start his own business over in Spokane, hooked up with some people who had a space. They urged him to take a faster track with his whole plan. He got the book. He even paid extra to have it shipped express to him. He read the first 7 chapters and pulled out of the project. he said he still wanted to start a brewery, but he realized that there was an awful lot of stuff that he hadn't considered, that he needed to consider more. And one thing he also said was that he figured he needed more money. To get going. I mean, I'm not saying that you have to do things absolutely top drawer. You know, we certainly haven't. You know, I think there's a lot of satisfaction in doing more with what might be considered less. But I do think, you know, I've seen some pretty sketchy equipment in some very small breweries that makes me nervous about what the quality of the beer is going to be like.
Hmm.
And I think people at least need to consider it. And when I wrote him back, I said, yeah, I want people not only to know what it's like to start a brewery and start making beer on a commercial level and in commercial quantities and qualities, but also to have their business be sound.
Yeah, in fact, in your book, it is most of the book in the beginning is talking about planning your business, organizing your business, financing your business, and then at the end it's, oh yeah, here's some tips on brewing at the end.
I figure people, you know, they're brewers presumably, so mm-hmm. they don't necessarily need my you know, tips on how to make beer. I figure we all have a certain level of proficiency as far as that's concerned. But I do feel like there are a lot of aspects that people who haven't started a business need to be aware of.
Yeah, it's got to be a business, a good business first, or else there won't be any beer produced.
Right.
So, if there is a person who is, you know, we all standing around the brew pot have visions of selling this, you know, saying goodbye to the man, you know, our employer, and selling this stuff that we love to make and doing that for a living. Other than getting, you know, experience in commercial establishments, what do you think is the first step, or are there several steps that have to be taken at the same time?
That's a hard one. I think the latter is probably the case. There are an awful lot of things that have to be done at the same time. Back in the early days, I mean, part of it is the maturity of the movement. You know, back in the early days, you know, a brewery could come out with a single beer, and just the novelty of producing beer was enough to at least attract people's attention. Then people started developing styles and all that stuff. And these days, the market is so broad and so varied that you really have to have a plan. You really have to have plotted a course in terms of what the products you're going to be making are, and what your identity is, and how it's all organized, how it's all put together. So I think you have to have a lot of sort of conceptual steps taken before you really even think about taking the first step in terms of producing beer. Does that answer your question? I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think, and you mentioned a plan. You actually have in the book your business plan for Elysian, which was, there's a lot, for those who aren't familiar with business plans, you're basically coming up with the whole thing on paper, and that's got to be a really useful exercise.
Yeah, well, like I say at the beginning of that chapter, a business plan is like a treatment for a screenplay. You know, you're sort of sketching out what a project might be like if it's allowed to come to fruition, if it's allowed to get started. And that was really interesting for me, too, to go back and look at our business plan and see that, you know, we really actually did a pretty good job forecasting where we were going to go and what we were going to do. It took a little longer than what our plan said it would. We got sidetracked along the way by opening a couple more pubs, but you know, it evolved. It wasn't far off from what we ended up doing.
And you started off with financing or a budget of $750,000. Is that correct?
Yep.
So is it easier to get money for a small brewery opening up?
I wouldn't say that necessarily. I mean, back then, we actually financed ours at a very good time to be doing that, because craft brewing was sort of taking off, as it is now. People finally kind of understood what it was. It wasn't like, you know, Ken Grossman or Jack McAuliffe or Fritz Maytag going out to a bank and them just sort of looking at them blankly and saying, I don't know what you're talking about, forget it, we're not giving you any money. It was a pretty good time for it, partly because, too, the statistics for openings and closings for brew pubs was perceived as being different from that of restaurants. I mean, everybody knows restaurants have a very high rate of failure,
mm-hmm.
you know, particularly if you look at their first 5 years of existence. And back then, people looked at brew pubs and they were like, wow, these things don't close. You know, 95% of them open and stay open. Well, I think finally things sort of settled out and people realized that a brew pub in particular is a restaurant, and that you have to consider, you know, many of the same factors when you're thinking of the relative health of those businesses and the relative degree of likelihood of their success. So that was a good time for people to be borrowing money, I think, for breweries. But right now, on the other hand, I think an awful lot of lenders are thinking, gee, This is a saturated market. Why do we believe that this one will succeed when there are literally breweries opening every day? I think they're probably more cagey now than they were back then, and they have more information. So I think it's probably far more difficult to get money now than it was back then. I can't use us as an example these days borrowing money because, of course, we have a track record. If you have a track record, you know, people are willing to lend you money. We haven't had any trouble since then. I think it's probably tougher now.
Yeah, but just in Northwest Arkansas, you're talking about market saturation. Just in the past year and a half, we've had, I lose track, 6 or 7 new breweries popping up around here of different sizes where there was only one brew pub in the area before. And it's kind of interesting because it's a kind of a wide spectrum of breweries, from a brew pub with basically a homebrew system in the back to, you know, full size sort of production breweries that are packaging and distributing. So it's kind of interesting because it's kind of a microcosm of what's going on, I guess, across the country.
Sure. Yeah.
You had some thoughts about scale and about nano breweries that are coming up. What do you think? Has your opinion changed or since you wrote the book?
No, it really hasn't. I mean, I do recognize that it's possible, you know, to make a go of a nano if you have a pub. I don't see how anybody can make any money if they are purely a production style nano, if they're trying to sell all their beer to just to restaurants and bars. You know, because the retail dollars of a pub are such a boon. You know, you just make more for per ounce of beer. But I do think that we have to recognize the value of our labors to the extent that we might as well be making. I mean, I know it's easy to say because larger equipment is more expensive, of course, and there are an awful lot of people who are just trying to get started any way they can. But I think there's a lot to be said for making 4 or 5 times as much beer with a day's labor than the people who just turn out, you know, a keg at a time.
Mm-hmm.
No, I still believe that, you know, 7 to 10 barrels is about the smallest system, maybe 5 under the right circumstances, that anybody should consider. I had a conversation just yesterday. I was over at Hop School in Yakima and was talking to a guy who started a brewery about a year ago. I think the very first keg of beer they sold was to our pumpkin festival last year. And, you know, he said that he's running into issues with the county, you know, not letting him have a tasting room, not letting him sell his beer. And, you know, he said, you know, he sort of took the words out of my mouth, although I wouldn't have said it because it would have made him feel bad. But he said he probably should have looked into what was going to be allowed before he opened the door. There's an illustration, too, of just being advised as to what the legalities of whatever is. But he was saying he was probably going to have to move, you know, that it was making it very difficult for him to operate because he couldn't sell beer on the premises.
Yeah, it seems like that would have been one of the first things that you have to look at is looking at the regulations not only in your state but in your municipality and where you are. I mean, shoot, even when you open a restaurant, you've got to make sure that you're in the right zoning area and such as that. So,
sure. And that, you know, and that goes for many other factors, too. I talk in the chapter about water treatment that, you know, when Magic Hat moved just down the road, you know, this is many years ago, of course, you know, when they did an expansion, they moved to a different town, and without adequately checking into it, they found that they had different water issues in this new place, and it almost closed them down. You gotta look into all that stuff.
Mm-hmm. We've got one of the breweries that opened up here in Northwest Arkansas is having issues because they're on a septic system instead of a sewer system, and so they undersized their septic system. So now they're having having to deal with that. So that's just one of many issues that you've got to look at. Before you even start talking about your identity as a brewery or what kinds of beers that you're going to brew, but talk about that. I mean, how do you carve a niche for yourself as a brewery? How do you start kind of feeling out who you want to be?
Well, that's a tough one. I mean, it's kind of a chicken and egg thing. I mean, you got to get started somehow, but how? I don't know. I guess a lot of people start just by having a theme to their name and the names of their beers that they make, and that, you know, maybe in turn suggests events that they can have and the way they can present themselves that way. I think that's a start. You know, the days are long gone when, well, actually they're not. I mean, you still see people starting, you know, Mr. XYZ starting out with XYZ Brewing Company, you know, naming it after themselves. It's far less common than it used to be. You know, I think, you know, the big brewers, the ones that are still with us, you know, were very often named after the family that started them, and that was enough branding. You know, it was a simpler time in terms of branding, but we have to acknowledge that that you have to differentiate yourself. I mean, but at the same time, there's so many places starting that I sometimes get the idea that people are almost naming themselves by random generation of words. I mean, there's a brewery in town that makes good beer. I really enjoy them, and but they're called Populux. I mean, what does that say about brewing? Nothing, really. It's just sort of a mid-century modern kind of moniker, and that's what the guy said. He said, "I like that stuff, but decided to name us after that." I'm not sure where he's going with that, you know, whether it's, you know, Eames Chair Pale Ale or, you know, whatever. But, you know, I saw that name and I thought, how did they come up with this? It's just a proclivity. It's just a taste. But how do you get started? I guess you just get started and see, you know, you're resilient. You sort of got to bob and weave with your fortunes and what sort of circumstances come along as you develop your business, who your clientele is, and be ready to, you know, have a sense of humor. I think a sense of humor is a great place to start.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you react to your customers, you react to what they like and who they are, and you just sort of be ready to retool at almost any instant.
And whatever name you pick has got to be approved by the government, doesn't it?
Approved by the government and not taken by somebody else.
Yeah.
You know, that's a huge issue these days. You know, every time we come up with a new beer, we do a search for, you know, the names that we're thinking about, and an awful lot of the time, the name we're thinking of has already been used.
Mm.
And it's not always a huge issue, say, in a pub, but down the road, say you want to package that beer, you're going to run into trouble if somebody's got it first. But yeah, sure, the government has to weigh in, and the government, you know, is also behind schedule because of all the breweries starting. I mean, they're not only have they been cut back in terms of personnel, but they're overwhelmed with applicants who may or may not even get going. But they've got to look at all these things and take them seriously, and that takes time.
Would you recommend, since the government agencies are so bogged down, I mean, one good thing is that I don't think they have to make a physical examination of the facility in person to give you a license anymore.
Right.
But since the line is so long on the paperwork, does it make sense to kind of hire a consultant or an attorney or someone to help you, someone who's been through the process before, to make sure all your ducks are in a row the first time it goes across somebody's desk?
Well, I don't think that's a terrible idea. I think there's probably a market for that. You know, I wouldn't be too surprised if we see, you know, consultants offering those kinds of services, people who have been through it. It's a lot to think about. But on the other hand, you'd probably better be aware of it, you know, just in a firsthand kind of way, just to understand what the entities, the agencies, and all that stuff, you know, to whom you're beholden. You need to sort of just have an awareness of that. So handing it off to somebody else might get the job done initially, but you'd better pay attention to what they're doing too.
Hmm. And I guess the craft brewing community is still pretty friendly, at least it is around here. So if you want to get into the business, I guess one possibility as well is that you could buy a beer for one of your potential competitors and, you know, kind of pick their brains on the pitfalls of going through the system.
Sure.
Too.
People do that all the time. And yes, you're right. It's a very friendly industry. I think, you know, particularly at the brewer level, we've all managed to more or less ignore the fact that we are competitors. And yeah, I mean, I talk to people all the time about various issues and give people advice. I do make the point in the book, too, that you have to be you also have to be mindful and recognize that you are taking somebody's time, and you know, don't ask too much of them. But people are generally willing to offer advice.
And you mentioned the word collusion somewhere in there about about talking about the pricing of products and such as that. So you want to be kind of aware of those pitfalls as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Talk about the pros and cons of going with, doing self-distributors, distributing your beer yourself versus signing up with a distributor. If that option is available to you in the area.
Yeah, well, I think, it's certainly possible to self-distribute, and I think it's very, very important that we all continue to fight for the right to self-distribute. You know, in many states, you're not allowed to do that. I think it's another way of, being able to keep your costs down. You know, it's cutting, if you are selling directly to the people who are going to be selling your beer, either in a store or in a bar, say, you don't have to, you can absorb, the benefits of that. You can get them, they will pay you the same price that they would pay for your beer if you sold it through a distributor, but you're not selling it to the distributor for a lower price. So it's important when you're really small to have that right. When you get to a certain size, and I say certain size, but that's sort of a sliding scale, varies for different people, you often do want to go with a distributor. And that's another thing that the large number of breweries that are starting up these days is putting a great deal of pressure on, because distributors only have so much bandwidth, they can only take on so many brands.
Mm-hmm.
So it might be difficult for people to attract the attention of a distributor to even get somebody to be willing to distribute their beer. Probably the best way to do it, of course, is to be a success and be a brand that is appealing to a distributor as you're trying to appeal to retail customers as well. But there are pros to both sides. There are cons to both sides. But the point I try to make above all in the chapter about distributors is how to manage them is that you need to make sure that, once again, that you're prepared in terms of knowing what the laws are governing the agreements that brewers and distributors enter into, but you need to make sure franchise laws. You need to know how strictly bound are you to a distributor that you take on. It might be easy for some brewers to be flattered by the attention and just say, oh, yeah, I'm going to go with this distributor because they want me. But, 2 years later or whenever, you might find that the relationship is not working and you're stuck in it because if you're in a state where franchise law is ironclad. So there's a lot to know about in advance once again, and there's a lot to think about as you go along and as you get bigger.
Yeah, in Arkansas, I've heard of stories of good breweries from out of state signing with a distributor that doesn't actually do anything with that relationship. And so nobody can get the beer because that one distributor has got the contract and is sitting on it, essentially.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's something that comes up. Sometimes a distributor will take on a brand, even though they have no intention of doing much with it, in order to keep it out of the hands of another distributor.
What about shelves?
Pretty craven, but it happens.
And then what about shelf space? I mean, even if you have a distributor that that wants to sell your product, my gosh, there's so many there's so many good beers out there. In addition to all the iterations of the macro brews out there, that there's only so much shelf space or tap space for new beers. So
it's true.
That's another thing that you've got to factor in.
That's another thing that makes a brew pub a very attractive option for people starting breweries because I make the point in there time and again that I don't think I actually use this phrase in the book, but I have in plenty of talks since that a brew pub properly put together is a fortress.
Mm.
If you control the sale of your beer and you have a loyal clientele that will come in and drink it on your premises, you are immune to many of the considerations of shelf space. You also shelf space and tap space in other bars. It's easy to say that because, of course, you're still part of the bigger picture and people still have all those other options. But if you've got people coming into your place regularly, that is a very attractive thing. But shelf space, tap space, those are along with the acquisition of raw materials and distributors' attentions, those are probably some of the biggest challenges to people start getting started as we go into the future.
I mean, ideally, what you want is you want customers going into stores and bars and such and asking for your product and asking for it to be put on the shelf or on the taps. But you've got to build that reputation first off.
Sure.
So you spend a lot of time talking about the sort of architecture, the organization of your company as you start up, talking about the differences between sole proprietors and C corporations and S corporations and LLCs, and there's a lot to think about in that as well. And it's not it's not the sexiest thing in the world.
No, it's pretty boring.
It's not making beer. But again, if you don't have a solid foundation for your business, you're not going to be making beer for the future. So there's a lot that people have to think about as far as tax liability and share of ownership and all of that. So a lot of food for thought in that area.
Yeah, and how you organize your company, affects everything down the road. I mean, I can think of lots of breweries who have different models than we do. People, for example, who have a certain way of doing business and dispersing profits and all that stuff dictated by the decisions they made going into it. A lot of people feel like, I just want to do this any way I can. I'm going to take this sort of path of least resistance in terms of getting started. But obviously, those decisions affect you throughout the life of your company.
For instance, if you start as a sole proprietor and then something happens, you could lose your house, essentially.
Sure. Yeah.
So again, professional consultant might not be a bad idea. And then there's the people who work for you. I mean, if you build a business, you're going to have people helping you with that. And there are all sorts of human relations issues that go along with that and regulations with employment and all that. You got to buy the poster and put it on the wall with all the all the required postings.
Yeah, well, yeah, maybe when you start your business, you think you're getting away from working for the man, but then you realize you are the man.
Your boss is a jerk and there's nothing you can do about it.
That's certainly a possibility.
But then there's then talking about your people, you talk about safety a lot because a brewery is full of hazardous conditions, and there's been some news in the past year or so and recently of unfortunate accidents in commercial breweries. Very tragic stuff.
Unfortunately, craft breweries are often sort of seat of the pants operations, and not enough consideration is given to safety. That's why I hammer on it, because no matter what your size, you've got to build that stuff in from the beginning.
And compounding it potentially is the fact that you're making beer, and there may be the temptation to have a lunchtime tasting, which may dull people's sensibilities before they go back out on the floor in the afternoon. Hopefully, people manage that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think people are getting stricter about that all the time.
It just makes sense.
Sure.
We've only scratched the surface. and I like the way that your book is organized, and I like the way that you attack each subject. It's kind of a no-nonsense, get down to business, talk about what you need to talk about, and get out kind of a thing. And there are little summaries at each chapter, highlights at the end of each chapter, which is also handy. But at the very end, you say the epilogue is called "You Can Do This." So after you go through all the stuff about all the things that people are going to have to take a look at and manage, and it's going to be different in every situation, you come out, come out of the huddle as a coach, saying that you can do this.
Well, I think you have to take an essentially optimistic tone. I mean, my thesis really is not don't start a brewery. It's not the Brewers Association guide to figuring out that you don't want to start a brewery. I mean, I hope that my message is practical rather than discouraging. I think we come at this from different angles. I think it's one of the things that makes our movement very interesting. is that we all did other things first, and we have different skills. You know, some of us are good at certain parts of running this kind of business. Some of us are good at others. You know, that's why partnerships are helpful, because, you know, I remember going into ours, you know, the three of us all felt like, each of us felt like we were doing the easiest part. But, yeah, you have to overcome your misgivings about, you know, what kind of person you think you might be with regard to starting a business, and realize that that's what you're going to do.
Yeah, I don't want to give the impression that the book is a downer. It's not. if I were 20 years younger, it would be inspirational. You know, it would be the seed to...
Well, there are a few laughs in it, too.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an enjoyable read. But, you know, at 48 years old, this seems like a lot of work to me. So I think I'll stick with the home brewing. And that'll be good news to my wife, because, you know, she's probably been wondering why I've been carrying around this book reading it. So it might be a relief to her. But it is a good – have you got any news as far as Elysian goes? I mean, you guys – y'all have been working with New Belgium a lot.
Yeah. We have done a lot of work with New Belgium. Actually, today we are brewing Trip 18, the 18th beer in the series that we've been brewing together here in Seattle for the last 4 or 5 years. And it's a wet hop beer. So that arrangement is healthy and ongoing. We for a while, you know, New Belgium helped us out with some production while we were sort of preparing to take the plunge and open a production brewery here in Seattle. You know, we haven't brewed there for a couple of years now since we opened that brewery. Well, a year and a half anyway. I don't think that's necessarily over for good. Who knows? We might end up making some more beer with them. But that's been, I think, a very productive. I know it's certainly our association with New Belgium is certainly one of the four or five factors that made it possible for us to expand. But I spend time every day trying to figure out how we can be useful to them too. And I like to, since I travel back and forth quite a bit, I found very gratifying, you know, going to some of their portfolio meetings and just offering my own perspective on some of the things I think that they're talking about. I think they appreciate, even though I hasten to say I'm not an expert at anything, but I know a little bit about a lot of things. And I think sometimes, you know, if you the people you work with day in and day out, you all tend to breathe the same air at times, and it's good to have an outside perspective. I certainly enjoy getting the perspectives from them, and I hope I help contribute to some of the things that they you know, allow me to be privy to as well.
So let me ask you to look into your crystal ball and get some thoughts about your thoughts about the future. I mean, right now, you know, there are companies like New Belgium, which is a craft brewery, but getting bigger all the time, you know, and so is Sierra Nevada and you know, Sam Adams. Is this kind of a honeymoon period, or at what point do large craft breweries become macro breweries, or is there a line?
Well, I mean, that's really a tough one. I mean, there have been lines drawn so far. I think most of the lines that have been drawn are essentially arbitrary. You know, for example, the line that the government set as, you know, what would the tax differential, where that occurs, you know, what is a craft brewery? You know, we've gone through a very difficult discussion over the past few years, trying to enlarge the number of what the definition of a craft brewery can be, you know, whether it's 2 million barrels or 6 million barrels. But the thing is that even 6 million barrels is a far, far cry from the 100 million barrels that, you know, Anheuser-Busch makes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so is there a line? It's more like a gulf. I think, you know, I think if Sam Adams brew 15 times, you know, they would be approaching, you know, and or more than that. I mean, it's just, there's just such a vast distance between, you know, the amounts of beer that those guys make and the amounts of beer that we make. I think we naturally cluster together. And, you know, I mean, if the definition were even larger, we would still be far from where they are. I don't know. It's a tough one. But I think it's important to recognize the differences between between what craft breweries do and what bigger breweries do. I don't know. It's a tough one, but I think it just seems obvious to me what the differences are.
Well, I hope that as these breweries, as all these breweries expand, that they'll kind of maintain that corporate culture, as they say, to have as much fun with the beers they seem to be having. To me, that seems to be the key.
Sure. I also feel like to be responsible, I really need to continue what I was just saying and recognize also that we share a lot of aims and ambitions and pursuits with the big brewers. We have to recognize that we are in the same industry. We face a lot of the same regulatory and taxation issues. And as much as we can, we need to be aligned in order to maintain the rights and responsibilities that we all share.
Sure. Well, Dick, this has been fun. If people are serious about wanting to start a brewery, this is a good read. It will give you a dose of reality, and also it'll be a good reference to make sure and come back and make sure that all your T's are crossed and your I's are dotted and such as that.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate the attention. Thanks for reading it, and thanks for taking the time to talk to me about it.
Well, thanks again to Dick. Once again, the book is not a downer. I didn't mean to give that impression, but it is a ton of good advice and a good overview of the kinds of things that you have to think about if you decide to go pro. It is challenging, but of course it's not impossible because lots of people are doing it all the time nowadays, even around here. So if you know what's ahead, maybe you'll be better prepared for what's coming along. So lots of good advice in that book. If you have brewing questions, showing suggestions. I've never read this copy before. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com, and please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Our Basic Brewing growler bags are available in our shop. Protect your precious homebrew and craft beers. You take it from place to place. Check out our support link where you can throw a couple of bucks into the tip jar by subscribing financially to our podcasts. Be sure to check out our DVDs, Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits. You can find them all on our site. We've got combo deals to save you a few bucks if you want to buy more than one DVD at a time. And you can check out our Basic Brewing shirts in the store, too. Our Brewer's Logbooks are in the store as well. Keep track of up to 50 batches of beer. That is required equipment around the brew pot. You can see a listing of fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com. And if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order them online in our online shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We appreciate the support there. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are Elenco Electronics TL16 Banana to Large Alligator Test Lead Set. If you want to hook up a banana to a large alligator and do a test, I would suggest you be careful. And Sunlight Thorn Resistant Prestavalve. That's one of those that I had to click on the thing to see what it was, and it's a bike thing. You need thorn-resistant valves if you're going through some thorns. Thanks again, everybody. Remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping. We greatly appreciate your support. And while we're talking about the Amazon thing, here's a tip from Max down in Georgia. Max says, here's a trick I learned and now starting to use with regard to Basic Brewing connection to Amazon. Instead of trying to remember to go to your site each time I want to shop at Amazon, I did the following. I went to basicbrewing.com, clicked on the Amazon link, and then entered the entire URL address, which included your Basic Brewing info, into a bookmark. And that's how Max does it now. You put a bookmark in his browser for the Amazon link. That way he doesn't have to go to our shop or our place, our page first. But you might want to. You never know. Might be something fun on there. Longest outro ever. And don't forget that you can also join longest outro ever And you can join the American Homebrewers Association or subscribe to Be Your Own Magazine. You can do both through the associate links on basicbrewing.com. Finally, that's all. Until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production out for Basic Brewing Radio, and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson, who has been photographed next to Nomad from Star Trek. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.